This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. But there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margo Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
Payne and Pendergast with you into the 9 o'clock hour we go. We'll hear from Nick Caserio here in just a second. Seth and I are going down the memory lane with the draft with the Texans. What were you looking up just now?
I was looking up. I wanted to look up because we're going to talk about Daniel Jeremiah from the NFL Network, who's nailed it with the Texans a couple times. Well, at least with two picks, most notably. He predicted that the Texans would draft C.J. Stroud, and then he predicted in his final mock draft that they would trade up for Will Anderson. So it's impossible not to think that he had some inside intel on that.
With the Cardinals, like from 12 to 3, the exact trade.
Right.
At least the amount they moved up, yeah.
So I was like, okay, what would he predict in 2022? 2022, he was not close at all with the Texans because with the number 3 pick, he had them taking Ikem Ekwonu, the offensive tackle.
Can you imagine if they drafted Ikem Ekwonu instead of Derek Stingley Jr.?
That wouldn't have been a good idea at all.
No, yeah. Where did Stingley go in that draft?
Stingley ended up going 12th,
yeah,
right before the Texans. And he had, Daniel Jeremiah had the Texans taking Jermaine Johnson, the second edge rusher.
Okay.
So, in passing up, I don't know if we're, you know what's interesting? Let's see where Kenyon Green went in, not in the first round.
Yeah,
in
no,
his mock draft.
That was it. Yeah. Stingley and Kenyon Green, compared to where they were going in mock drafts that year, were both reaches by the Texans.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, that's an interesting one.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I wonder exactly how, because I want to give Daniel Jeremiah credit for having a lot of sourced info and all that. Yet at the same time, at least as it relates to the Texans, he didn't quite nail it that year.
Do you still have that open right now, that 2022 draft? Where did Kyle Hamilton go in that draft?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, because Jordan Davis, I think the Texans would have passed on Jordan Davis, which they did kind of by trading down.
By trading back,
draft him.
Yeah.
Hold on one second. So, who did you ask about?
Kyle Hamilton.
Kyle Hamilton. NFL.com is a weird site because it... Okay. The Eagles with the 15th pick.
Okay, so right in that neighborhood there. Yeah.
The Eagles. Oh, no. Okay, so he had Jordan Davis going to the Ravens and then Kyle Hamilton going to the Eagles.
Yeah.
So he was off on that one.
He had him in the right neighborhood, but the wrong houses.
Right neighborhood, but if he would have known, really, really known, he would have known that, man, if the Ravens have a choice between Jordan Davis and Kyle Hamilton, they'll totally take Kyle Hamilton, not Jordan Davis.
But the Eagles jumped ahead of the Ravens
Davis. So you're 100% correct.
Yeah.
Yes, you're 100% correct.
Yeah.
Because the Eagles jumped. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, the Eagles jumped up to take Jordan Davis with the Texans. Yeah. So, and then the Texans wound up with Kenyon Green.
So was Jordan Davis then Kyle Hamilton?
Yes, it was Jordan Davis 13, Kyle Hamilton 14, and then Kenyon Green 15.
I had those flipped in my brain.
Yeah. Okay. Here's Nick Caserio yesterday at his pre-draft press conference saying, we will never and never have drafted on need.
Yeah, well, we've never drafted for need around here. I mean, we're never going to. So we're going to pick the best player that we feel fits our program. regardless of the position. I'd say other than quarterback, I mean, I'd say pretty much any position is on the table. So like it always is. So try to stay true to our board. That's the reason we grade the players. So we put the players on the board. We grade them accordingly. We value them accordingly relative to what we think the role is going to be. And then we take them off the board as we see fit. So, I mean, that's not going to change.
And they evaluate the quarterbacks too. We asked him about that when he was on with us a couple of weeks ago. Nick Caserio, if you missed that interview, it's up on our podcast page, Payne and Pendergast. He said something later in the press conference, which, you know, obviously we've known for years, but him saying it in conjunction with all this draft talk, that there are other ways to get players in the building. You know, that I start to soften a little bit on just how much I feel like that general managers, not just Nick, but general managers in general that say we never draft on need. I always feel like they treat it like it's some sort of weakness that they draft on need. Like, you know, it's okay to draft. It's okay to need things. And then you have an opportunity to go get those things and then go get them. But every GM, it feels like, says, we don't draft on need. You do forget that we just had free agency. There's going to be more. There's still more free agents out there. Yeah. You point this out all the time. There's going to be guys available in trades probably still, even after
especially
the draft.
I think the other thing, too, is that I think every GM in his heart of hearts wants to draft best player available because it's a good strategy. Like, the Ravens have probably done the best job of it. They famously drafted Jonathan Ogden when they already had two good starting offensive tackles. It was just like, hey, that's the best player available. And they've been like that for decades, where they genuinely take the best player available. Because when you start drafting for need, and GMs know this, you're overrating your own ability to rate these players. That you think, oh, okay, this is the guy for us right now, when it's really a crapshoot. And it's that as a GM, it's like a baseball player at the plate. Like, yeah, you're gonna miss two times as many as you get a hit. And it's not as simple as okay, this is the guy we need. Let's take him right now.
Yep.
So if you try to just over time draft the best player available, you end up with a team full of good players.
Yeah, it's a great point. Nick Caserio talked about small school guys yesterday, evaluating small school guys. John Harris had the Texans selecting Gray Zabel, North Dakota State interior offensive lineman, in his mock draft earlier, and I thought made a pretty good case for why he would be a good fit for the Texans. But this we know, that in the four drafts he's conducted for the Texans so far, Nick Caserio has picked one non-power conference player, and it was Tank Dell, whose team went into the Big 12 the following year. So it's not like he's been plucking guys from, you know, South Kennesaw State and Chattanooga and places like that. Here was Caserio yesterday on evaluating small school guys. Do you feel like after listening to this that Gray Zabel is still in the crosshairs here for the Texans?
I think the nature of the draft in the end, there's a projection element, regardless of how much a player has or has not played. When you're playing at a lower level, quote unquote, a lower level, there's obviously going to be an adjustment period that takes place. So is there an opportunity to evaluate that, like you said, in the Senior Bowl or East West or something like that? I mean, I'd say those two games done a pretty good job of maybe bringing in some lower level, smaller school players. But it's a huge jump. There's no question about it. So how are they going to handle it? I'd say, you know, going back to, you know, Duggar, there's another example in New England, you know, basically small school kid. I mean, they were playing against like the 20 of us in this room, like basically nobody. And then, you know, went to the Senior Bowl, and I'm including myself in that equation. And then, you know, went to the Senior Bowl and did okay. So is there some evidence along the way? But so you have to, again, it's all right, here's the player. Here's what we think he does well. You might have to not downgrade it based on a level of competition, but there's a little bit of difference, you know, what the guy does against LSU versus what he does against, you know, Western Tennessee State or somebody like that, if that's who they're playing every week. So you're not going to eliminate a player, but, you know, give him an opportunity. But, you know, not every player can make that jump. So, I mean, it's case by case like a lot of this is, but there's a projection element that's involved. No question about it.
Is there anything that moves you one way or the other on the Texans taking a guy like Gray Zabel in the first round?
I think this is where, with Nick, he's talked before about, you know, with Derek Stingley himself, one of the things they liked about it was the ability to watch him versus high-caliber competition for multiple years, including
in practice.
Practice film,
yeah.
Going against Jamar Chase and Justin Jefferson and all these other guys.
Two best guys in the league right now.
Right, so when you want to try to have as much evidence as possible that I can trust this guy, that like he's done good things for a long time, I can see why he just trusts that more, and it's not like he's saying the guys from the smaller schools can't do it. The Patriots, and he provided a couple examples yesterday, the Patriots drafted a bunch of small school guys, and some of them worked out very well for him. I think Nick just likes that huge body of work that he can judge people on. Look, I'm a small school guy, and it's 100% true. Everything that Nick just said, there's only so much you can tell from guys whipping up on people who are physically inferior to them. It's like, that's the bare minimum. Like, okay, he played at a lower school. Did he beat up on those kids?
Yeah.
Yes, he did. But I can't just extrapolate that and say, oh yeah, well, he would have done the same thing in the SEC every week. So that's where I feel like there are a lot of things I really, really like about Gray's Abel. When I try to put myself in Nick Caserio's shoes,
yeah.
I think that part, that uncertainty about it is what's going to knock Gray Zabel down below a guy like Donovan Jackson or Kelvin Banks or some of the other offensive linemen that might be sitting right there. Those guys have done it at a higher level of competition for a much longer time than 1 week in Mobile.
We'll get to Daniel Jeremiah here in just a second. As long as we're talking about this, I've had fun talking about this with you today because you brought up your draft selection story earlier. I thought was great. For you, the first time you physically went against an NFL player was probably in training camp, your rookie year. The last person you'd gone against physically was probably against Princeton or Yale or somebody like that. Like, what was that like? Like, what was the, did the difference feel like? What did you feel like in that moment is what I'm trying to ask.
I felt fine.
Yeah.
I felt like I was beating the crap out of the rookies.
Yeah.
That's where I got pissed that a lot of these guys even got
scholarships.
Ahead
of you. Yeah.
Because I felt like, man, there were guys in the Ivy League that were a tougher challenge than some of you fat clods.
Yes.
That just had overactive pituitary glands when you were 16 years old. So you got a scholarship and you went to a football factory. Then you get drafted because you're 6'6", but you're a wuss. You know, like I very much kept and retain to this day that my chip against soft offensive linemen who were just oversized doofuses that got scholarships and sometimes drafted just because they're oversized doofuses. Screw those guys. That's what I felt. Now, as far as the actual good players, that was an adjustment. Yeah, the Jaguars had big offensive linemen too. So you're going against guys that really like, it was like, oh, this is a different world.
There's a different,
guys
are, dimensions are different.
These guys are huge and they can move really well, and I've never seen anything like it. But my college coach, Pete DeStefano, was a really, really good position coach. So I had really good technique above and beyond what pretty much any rookie from any football factory school had. So it was an easier adjustment for me than people thought it would be. So I wasn't as blown away by it. Now, but that's in training camp. Then you get into the real games, and then you realize, like, oh, okay. Oh, those huge mountainous athletic dudes were actually going three-quarter speed in practice.
Yeah.
So it was more of the first couple weeks of training camp, it wasn't as big a deal for me as, like, the actual adjustment in season.
Your promo that you cut on fat rookie offensive lineman was – I expected a good answer. That was
–
you can just drop the mic and leave if you want to.
No, and that's where I still have a grudge against whenever I see in a scouting report that an offensive lineman is tough and nasty.
Yeah.
My first thought is, all right, well, why didn't he play defensive line? And second, all right, he's been doing it against guys in the MAC, or he's been doing it against these, you know, he faces two or three actual men a year in the SEC.
Trevor Penning is what
he's
I'm hearing.
He's doing it versus boys. Yeah, let's see how he does versus actual men.
Yep. Here's Daniel Jeremiah, former scout. That was a great answer. That was just an outstanding answer. Daniel Jeremiah, former Ravens scout, current draft analyst for the NFL Network. Typically, at least with the Texans, 2 years ago, very accurate with his mock draft of drafting C.J. Stroud and trading up to get Will Anderson. He predicted that. Here's who he thinks the Texans states with great positivity here.
The Houston Texans, it's going to be the law firm of Booker or Banks. Like, they're drafting an offensive lineman between those two guys, whoever's there.
Okay. I mean, he's stating that as facts.
So he's basically saying Tyler Booker or Kelvin Banks. Tyler Booker, the offensive guard out of Alabama, or Kelvin Banks from up the road at University of Texas.
And you're good with either of those guys.
Yeah, I am. And I think that, you know, John brought up the minuses on any of them, and that you have to remind yourself that, okay, the guys that are there at 25 are going to have minuses. And the one with Kelvin Banks that makes me, or I guess that I, needs to improve, and he needs to prove that he can do it, is that, man, there's times where his upper body and his lower body aren't quite attached. He's getting out. He's got his hands on a guy, but his feet are still back a couple steps behind in the play. And he gives up an edge because of that. He's athletic enough to make up for it, but you just, with offensive linemen, and this is one thing I do like about Gray Zabel, is you want to be able to show that the guy can win with his feet. Because if you try to win with just your hands, then you end up getting a holding call because you're getting dragged behind a guy. But that's, as it is with anybody with the 25th pick overall, that's what he needs to improve on. I think he has the athletic ability to improve on it, but it's not a slam dunk guarantee, which is why he might go. Now, Kelvin Banks, I think, is probably going to go, at least according to mock drafts,
ahead of 25,
going like around 15 or so the Texans might have to trade up for him. That's where it gets maybe a little bit rich for me. I feel like there's more, there's just not quite as polished a product as I'd like to see in it at the 15th or 16th pick.
Well, is Nick Caserio paying attention to this conjecture on the mock drafts? This is what he had to say about it yesterday.
I would just say some are probably more relevant than others because some are getting the information from the teams. Like, they're not just making it up themselves. Like, they're talking to teams saying, hey, you know, so that's how they're building it, right? So they're getting intel. I'd say agents are involved. Like, they're getting intel. All right. So you try to gather information, but you have to be careful about how much you actually put in the information. And then what can you trust and what can you rely on? And you're just trying to get yourself in the ballpark.
We need to play that cut again tomorrow. My project for today, I'm going to go to Drew Doherty's mock draft rundown, or the where he gathers all the mock drafts. I want to come up with the ones we think are the most reliable ones. Like, which ones are the ones that Nick and the Texans probably use?
Yeah, well, and I do think he talked about how their process has changed in various ways without giving any detail, really, about, you know, they do things differently every year. They're always changing
every
things.
Yeah.
And Nick has talked about the mock drafts before. In a way where he said that he almost like acknowledged their existence and that there's some value to them. But I don't think he's ever given an answer quite as specific as that before, has he? So I think, you know, he said somebody should, I feel like this is one thing I suspect with Nick. Every time he says somebody should do a study on it, I feel like they've already done a study on it. That might be a tell that, like, he's like, oh, like, oh, yeah, somebody should do a study on that because certainly we haven't.
He knows the answers already, yeah.
Yeah, they got 20 people that are involved in sports science or analytics or whatever in that building. I feel like somewhere along the way, if Nick is saying somebody should do a study, he's got plenty of people that can do that study.
That's a great point. Text message, Jim Adler, the Texas Hammer text line. Seth is still just mad about Trevor Penning. Maybe. Favorite draft season was, this is another text. Favorite draft season was when Penning was coming out. And Seth just keeps yelling, he's not a badass if he waits till after the whistle to throw guys into the ground after he gets beat.
It continues to this day.
Yeah.
Because he is an awful, awful pass protector. We saw that a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. The Texans destroyed Trevor Penning. Mm-hmm. It was embarrassing.
Yeah.
He should have quit football after that. But he is a good run blocker. He's turned into a good run blocker. But a lot of the times, people gush over, like, ooh, did you see him drive that free safety out of bounds? Like, oh, did you see him drive that cornerback downfield? Like, 100, all right, yeah.
150 pounds lighter than him.
Good for him, yeah. Oh, and it also bothers me that the people that still were adamant that they want to gush about Trevor Penning, all anybody ever cares about is this Pro Football Focused pass protection grade. With Trevor Penning, all of a sudden, they become old school grinders.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Look at his run blocking grades.
Yeah.
Like, all right, yeah.
Yep.
It's exactly what you want to spend a first round pick on these days, is a run blocking specialist.
That's right. Yeah. A tackle. All right. Payne and Pendergast with you. Is this the story that looms over the Rockets this entire postseason? And is it a distraction that's going to spoil it for you? We'll tell you what it is coming up next. This was Shams Charania yesterday of ESPN, NBA reporter, newsbreaker from ESPN, talking about the playoffs and talking about the Houston Rockets and a big name that has been tied to them of late.
The biggest move of all of that was Ime Udoka and his hiring. He's really the engine of this team, the leader of this team. And this is a Houston team we need to keep an eye on in this playoff run. Yeah. Because when you think about monitoring who does well early in the playoffs and who might struggle, and there is going to be a level of mutual interest. There has been already with them and Kevin Durant with the Suns. Seeing how they do, listen, if they win a couple rounds, they might be good where they're at. If you lose early, you don't win or enough to where you want to.
Right.
Could you look at a guy like Kevin Durant once again this offseason? Monitor them.
I don't know that there's like a threshold of the playoffs where there's this, Seth, where there's this Durantometer. And if the Rockets make the conference finals, then the Durantometer gets turned down to zero. If they get eliminated in the semis in seven games, the Durantometer is at three. But if they get blown out and lose in five and offense is the issue, the Durantometer is at a six. Like this is one of my concerns about the playoffs. It's not a concern about the Rockets and the way they play. I've got concerns about that, and I've also got things I feel great about with the Rockets. It's that, especially after games where offense is the issue, and especially after games where half-court offense is the issue, perhaps late in games, and they don't have a killer, an assassin who can go get you the buckets that you need in the last 2 minutes of a game, that there is going to be a KD cloud hanging over this team during the playoffs, particularly after games like that. And I don't want it to ruin this return to the postseason for me. It's been a while, man.
Yeah. Like, the thinking too far in the future. And every time, like when we talked to Vanessa Richardson yesterday, I thought about asking a Kevin Durant question, and then I thought, it doesn't feel right just because it's a cloud. It would be a cloud hanging over it of like, you start, instead of watching a playoff series to just hope your team wins,
enjoy it.
You're watching it like analytically decide whether or not they need to make an offseason move. Let's cross that bridge when we come to it. From Rafael Stone's perspective and Ime Udoka's perspective, like, I don't think they're thinking, hey, this is where we find out whether or not we get Kevin Durant.
No chance.
But if after the playoffs are over, let's say worst case scenario, the Rockets they lose to the Warriors and they don't look good at all. Is that going to sway them? Do you think it sways those two guys more towards getting Kevin Durant? Or do you think they look at it as, all right, yep, we've still got a lot more work to do that we can't just fix with one guy, and that's not the way we want to fix it. We want to build it from the ground up, and maybe it's two or three players here or there, more so than it is one fell swoop. Let's try to bring Kevin Durant in.
I think it sways them towards Durant.
Yeah.
I do. I think it does. And I think the thing with Durant is it's not going to be a long-term thing. He's in his late 30s. I don't think the amount you're going to have to give up for him is this major haul that's going to change the composition of your roster. I think, put simply, I think they can get Kevin Durant on this team without giving up Alperen Şengün, Jalen Green, or Amen Thompson. Mm-hmm. And those are the three foundation. With all due respect to guys like Jabari Smith and Tari Eason, that might be the most noteworthy piece you'd have to give up in a deal for Durant would be one of those two, Jabari or Tari. For me, unless Jalen Green or Amen Thompson's untouchable. I think Şengün and Jalen Green are close to that. But depending on how they play in the playoffs, I might be a little more open to it. But I think you can get Kevin Durant here with a package of Phoenix's picks that you have, including one that's a lottery pick, and some combination of Cam Whitmore or Reed Shepard, one of Jabari and Tari, not all those guys, but that, like, I think you can draw a glass ceiling, Seth, on the level of young player you need to give up. And then you'd probably have to give up one of either Fred VanVleet or Dylan Brooks just to make the salaries work out in the whole thing.
I guess the only other part of it, and the huge X factor that we'll never know for sure what it means, is that Udoka has experience with Kevin Durant from the Nets.
Yes.
And if you look back at Kevin Durant with the Warriors, It's almost impossible to say this to where it doesn't sound the wrong, but he wasn't quite a fit with the Warriors.
Right.
And yet they were an incredible basketball team.
Yeah.
But we saw that the dynamics of him not quite liking that system and him not wanting to run it the way they do, and most notably when he and Draymond Green got into it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a seamless fit. And but they were still just, they had too many awesome basketball players for it to not be a great
team.
That's
exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, but that's where I wonder with Udoka and having worked with Kevin Durant and everything, I wonder if Udoka thinks that, hey, look, it's not as seamless as just introducing Kevin Durant in, and it's like adding, you know, Nitro to the video game.
Yeah, I think as star players go, like super duper stars, I think Durant is a guy who's very blendable on almost any type of situation. Like, he's not a ball dominant guy. He can't be if he wants to, but he can be an endpoint on a lot of this stuff. You know?
I mean, the big issue in Golden State was more, if I remember correctly, it was more about him just not, he wasn't feeling the whole pick and roll vibe as much as
maybe as
they do in Golden State.
And then Draymond just poured gasoline on the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's, Paul Pierce made this point earlier this week. He did this on Speak on FS1, said that Kevin Durant is a coach killer.
I hate to say it, and not in a negative way, but he really is.
I'm glad you started with Paul.
No, seriously, though. But that's what comes with guys like KD, because when you have a guy of KD's caliber like him and LeBron, expectations come with them. Mm-hmm. So as a coach, if you don't fulfill those expectations, you're always on the hot seat. And that's why you've seen so many different coaches for LeBron and also KD. You know, but there's only a few guys that you could put in that category. And those two are the guys, but he's definitely a coach. Because you look up, he has, in 17 years, 8-9 coaches. It's just expectations come, and rightfully so, because of who KD is, to where if they don't perform at a certain level, then they bring somebody else in. Okay. It just is what it is.
Okay, so I'm going to, without fact-checking Paul Pierce, let's keep in mind, Kevin Durant's played on 4 teams. So when he's played for 8 or 9 coaches, well, he played for Scott Brooks practically the whole time.
Yeah,
you know, during the glory years of OKC, he played for Steve Kerr the entire time in Golden
State.
Still employed. He's mostly, I think, referring to the fact that Phoenix has started to cycle through coaches every year while Durant's been there. They might have an owner who's a psycho like that. Yeah. That could very well. Like,
this is the issue I have with him using that term, coach killer. It's that, like, he's trying to redefine what the meaning of coach killer is. You know, Cam Newton last year tried to redefine what game manager means and then acted like, no, you all don't understand. I can call somebody a game manager because actually it means this. A coach killer, typically, when most people hear coach killer, it's a diva-type dude who either won't work with the coach or publicly lambastes him or something, like that kind of stuff. The coach killer, because of high expectations, it's not the right term. Like, coach killer, it has a lot of connotations to it that I think it's unfair to apply that to Kevin Durant.
I think James Harden was a coach killer when he was here. Ask Kevin McHale. You know, like, hey, Kevin McHale
benched James
Harden in a playoff game, the greatest comeback in Rockets history, and then 11 games into the next season, Kevin McHale's gone. I don't think that's a coincidence at all. And I think the whole coach killer notion, that's why I played that audio, Seth, was to diffuse it when it comes to the Rockets. Kevin Durant could come here, and Ime Udoka is still the most powerful person in the building there.
Yeah.
When it comes to the basketball, the on-court operation part of things.
I'd say, like, Kyrie Irving's a more accurate description of a coach killer.
Maybe.
He lobbied in Cleveland for it. And then he brings a certain amount of drama with him that makes, when there's
that
other
affects
words
the overall team.
Adding a whole lot of drama, which gives the impression to an owner sometimes that just things are way out of control. Durant's not that guy.
No.
Like, Durant doesn't bring that drama to it. No. I think even whatever issues he had with the offense in Golden State, if it weren't for Draymond Green, then it, as you pointed out, it wouldn't have been nearly as public or just dramatic. It might have been just the classic, like, hey, why don't we do it this way? And then somebody else saying, like, we like to do it this way. Yeah. Okay, cool.
No, dude, Twitter.
Let's go light up a joint.
Twitter has more to worry about an ornery Kevin Durant than Ime Udoka does. You know, Kevin Durant, you know, he'll get more up in his feelings about stuff that randos are saying to him on social media than anything. But you do need to be ready to be coached tough if you come play for Ime Udoka, but that's where maybe them knowing each other. Granted, Ime wasn't a head coach when they were together in Brooklyn, but at least they know each other a little bit.
That's Kevin Durant's technique for sublimating his rage, is like, whatever he gets angry about, he just takes it out on social media.
Good.
He gets mad at Ime, he's going to go thrash some 16-year-old on Twitter, and that's how he gets it.
Yeah. There you go. All right, final segment coming up. A little bit of breaking news. A legend from an iconic on-screen institution is retiring. We will tell you who that is coming up next. I have Payne and Pendergast. A little bit of news out of the world of college football that I would say a staple of college football coverage, Seth. Lee Corso, who is turning 90 in August.
Oh, my gosh. Been, I don't know. Yeah, I guess I knew he was that old.
He'd been around a while. Yeah, he's been doing College Game Day since 1987. And a former Indiana coach, and way more people know him as the guy on College Game Day. He will be retiring this coming season. He'll make his final headgear pick. And those who know Lee Corso, that's his gimmick. At the end of College Game Day, everybody's making their picks, and whatever the big game is, he's got the two heads of the mascots costumes there, and he picks the one he thinks is going to win. He will make his final headgear pick on the first College Game Day of the season this coming year, Saturday, August 30th, week one of the 2025 college football season. Corso, who turns, and they don't say what game it is. I don't think they've picked which game it's going to be yet. Corso, who turns 90 in August, this is courtesy of Adam Schefter, has been a part of college football's premier pregame show since it debuted in 1987. He has been. That will feel a little strange. Now, he's obviously lost his fastball a little bit. He's had medical issues through the years.
Well, he had a, you know what? It is crazy, though. I didn't realize it had been this long ago. It was 2009 when he had his stroke.
Yeah.
And that affected his speech more so in the first couple of years. But then he goes off a script now where he didn't before. He's in his 80s, and there's going to be a little bit of decline. He's seemingly suffered no decline in energy or anything.
No.
Just an impressive, impressive long career.
That's a hell of a run, and it's not like he was a great college coach either, but a little like Dick Vitale in that way, like, you know, Vitale was a good college coach, and then he got to the pros with the Pistons, and it was bad. But he had a big personality, you know, and Vitale's still kicking with us, and he's made it through multiple cancer treatments and whatnot. But yeah, Lee Corso, man, that is going to be a tough one for Kirk Herbstreit, is my prediction. They are very close, the two of them, and Herbstreit is a guy who wears his emotions on his sleeve, as we've seen some over the last couple of years. I don't think Herbstreit makes it through that last headgear pick with Corso without the faucets getting turned on seriously.
Have they ever had a Lee Corso head, big bobblehead or not? I feel like that'll have to be the first one of they need to have Herbstreit do it with a Lee Corso head on.
Herbstreit puts a Corso mascot head on his head.
Yeah, you keep it because the problem is that they're going to try to extend it with using Pat McAfee or something, and it just it's not going to feel right.
No,
that's the most likely candidate to replace. Some of the stuff Lee Corso would do would be Pat McAfee, and I would prefer to just let some of those things rest.
That would be great if they made Saban do it. If all of a sudden Saban, like, sorry, Nick, this is a sponsored thing, the headgear thing, and so we feel like you, the aging coach, would be the easiest one to. God, Saban would be so angry about that.
Saban has shown the ability to have more fun than people thought he would. And yet the moment last year that was most poignant was when Shane Gillis made a joke about bribing recruits or whatever, and Saban did not find any humor in it whatsoever.
No.
Yeah. And then Shane Gillis talked about that, and basically McAfee and somebody else had egged him on. Said, no, he'll be cool with it.
He'll
think it's hilarious. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
And Shane Gillis afterwards was like, what the hell, guys?
the funniest ones that I see on a regular basis is when somebody's got either a phone camera or there's still like a hard camera rolling during the break on ESPN, and it zooms in on McAfee and Saban during the break, and they're not talking to each other, but McAfee's like sitting there playing like fake drums along with whatever band is playing, and Saban's just sitting there staring straight ahead, not moving, looking like a statue, and like McAfee's just bopping along to everything, and it's so memeable. It's really, really funny. Now, there are people weighing in on this and the Corso thing, saying, sorry, but Corso should have been gone a few years ago, about time. I mean, obviously, based on his performance level to what he was pre-2009 was the year, Seth, you said. I get it. I think he had, in the eyes of ESPN, there was never a point in me watching Game Day where I felt like Lee Corso being on there ruined it for me or anything.
Yeah,
like
what
that.
Does it lower the discourse of a bunch of analysts saying, hey, they've got a good offense,
yeah,
but that team has a good defense.
Right, right.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, look at these signs. Yeah.
I think they leaned into it appropriately. You know, they like the headgear gimmick is an iconic thing. I'll be surprised if anybody takes that over. You know, like I think that to me feels like something that retires with Corso. That's his thing, man. Unless he blesses it, unless he leaves like a will, like he bequeaths it to somebody and says, I am leaving. Hey, Nick, Saban, I'm leaving you the headgear. That would be a lot of pressure on Saban to have to do that after that. Say, you know, if Corso left it for him like it was a will or a testament.
Oh, then it would be, they feel like it's your duty to fulfill it.
Yeah. Somebody leaves you a article of clothing or a car, like, I guess I got to drive this thing for a little while, I suppose.
I haven't watched College Game Day in a long time.
Really?
Has it changed all that much from, say, 5 or 6 years ago?
McAfee is a big change on there.
Yeah.
You know, he's a big energy thing on whatever he drops on. So he's on there. I mean, he's on Monday Night Raw. He's on everything. McAfee being on there is a big change. As far as the whole vibe of it, no, not at all. And now there's Big Noon Saturday over on Fox, which is essentially, in many ways, a carbon copy of Game Day. Yeah. I mean, that's like a big battle. Fox almost wooed Reese Davis away from ESPN to host Big Noon Saturday. Like, those pregame shows, which are all on college campuses now, are big business.
The biggest thing is that obviously it's not like I haven't watched it at all, but right, I just haven't really sat down and watched it.
Yeah.
It's fun to see the level of excitement by the college kids.
Yes.
It's cool. Hey, look, these kids can still get excited about something that happens in person.
I think that's
all right. Yeah, look at that. You actually took the effort to make a sign and everything. Good for you.
Yeah, I think it's a great table setter as a viewer, too. Like, I'm a big college football fan. That show gets me in the mood to sit down and watch college football, just watching the energy of everything, I think is great. Just retire the mascots with the mascot heads with the coach. That's from Lacey. Yeah, I'll be interested to see what they do. Do you think they give everyone at the desk an opportunity for one last "not so fast, my friend"? That's his catchphrase. Yeah. In the Corso. Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably. I mean, they're going to make a big deal out of it. I think the fact that he's coming back for just one show is probably indicative that they realize that, yeah, we've probably gone maybe a year or two, a little longer with this, and maybe.
Well, I mean, ultimately,
maybe
it's probably his decision.
Maybe his choice too.
Or maybe they asked him, like, hey, would you like to accept a lesser role or something? And he's like, no, I would have quit 5 years ago. You guys just wouldn't ask me, please.
Him and Hubie Brown both walking away at age 90. Like, is that the new threshold? Are we going to be doing this at 90, Seth?
Maybe shoot for 90. Yeah, I don't mind.
40 more years
for you?
Better
than a real job. My God, yes.
Yeah, but I got to be doing something for sure. Yeah.
The problem is we need our listeners to stay as healthy. I've never shied too far away from, like, I don't feel overly eager that I have to, you know, reach out to the 23-year-olds or something and get my foot. You're never going to catch me wearing jeans that are a little too stylish or anything, because for the most part, in sports streaming / radio, our audience can follow us right up to the grave.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, 10 or 15 years from now, I'll just start doing ads for Depends. Yeah. And there they are. They're there with me. So as long as enough of you out there stay healthy and alive and not deaf. That's a big one.
Yeah.
Stay not deaf.
Not deaf.
Long enough to keep listening to me until I'm 90, I'll probably be doing something.
Hold up. I'm surprised you say not deaf, because you point this out all the time. If they're willing to watch us on the YouTube and the Twitch with closed captions.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because, like, the closed captions always nail it. Yeah. So, but by 10 to 15 years from now, they will. They'll be very, very accurate with the closed captions.
Well, when you're deaf, you don't have much choice but the closed captions.
Just don't go Helen Keller on us between now and 90, okay?
Exactly. Something.
Still hard to. I can't come to your home and scrawl out letters on the palm of your hand to up with Nick Caserio.
The show will not be done in Braille, okay? We're not doing this show in Braille, all right? 713-572-4610. That's the Jim Adler, the Texas Hammer text line. We got a lot of texts from earlier when we were talking about Caserio and reaching. You can't tell me that Kenyon Green wasn't a reach based on need. That's in response to Casario saying that the team will never draft based on need.
Okay, this is the problem, and this is where this is one of the parts of draft season that annoys me, is that people think they know what everybody's draft board looks like. And because Kenyon Green wasn't that high on a lot of people's draft boards, they assume that it's a reach just by, like, people assumed it was a reach for Derek Stingley. Please tell me all of the positions in 2022 that weren't positions of need for the Houston Texans. I think that
needs everything.
Yeah. I think that the fact of the matter is that at the very least, Nick Caserio misjudged the value of the three players that were there right then. Yeah. And he probably wasn't over the moon about any of them, right? Kyle Hamilton, Jordan Davis, and Kenyon Green. And he trades back there because, maybe he felt he was still reaching for Kenyon Green. I don't think they were, if they were so in love with Kenyon Green because they needed him at that position, they wouldn't have traded back. Yeah.
Yep.
And so it's just, you never know what genuinely is a reach or not. With some teams, like the Raiders for a while, when it happens year after year, when they're consistently drafting above what the consensus is on guys, then you can say, all right, these guys are just either reaching or just completely out to lunch. But in any given year, you just flat out don't know how many people had Kenyon Green ranked midway through the first round and how many didn't. You just don't know.
Yep, you don't know. John Lopez, Reggie Atatula, they are here.
Howdy.
What's up, fellas?
Yo.
How you doing?
Great.
Hey.
Seven.
On a scale of 1 to 10?
I believe so.
Okay, yeah. And by the way, thank you for attributing the notion of, what was it yesterday that you did?
The seven? No, it's going to be today because we never actually got
to it.
Because Casario, we circled back.
Oh, I didn't realize that was going to be 40 minutes. Okay.
Seven sort of.
It's the seven-point plan.
The seven-point plan for the Rockets,
for
right?
Every team to win an NBA championship, for NBA champions, you know, to check off.
Okay.
How many do the Rockets check off?
How do the Rockets check off? And these are not statistical like Reggie's were.
No. Yeah. I don't need no freaking numbers.
Okay, Seth and I need to check on something for you. I like the statistics, by the way, Reg. I love that kind of thing.
Thanks,
that
man.
Sort of whittles the entire pool down based on those numbers.
Well, don't worry about the New York Knicks is ultimately.
Yeah. Seth and I read a text earlier. Nick Caserio cursed in the press conference
live on airwaves.
Second time he's done that. Yeah, did Figgy bleep it?
Did he drop it? Good job, Figgy.
Is it true that you guys put the Caserio, you know, that his proclivity for cursing now is on me and Seth?
Oh,
no,
wow.
No, that's the exact opposite.
Oh, okay. That's why I'm checking.
What's up with
someone
these
texted in and said, in the loop, blamed you two for Nick Caserio
that's
cursing.
Somebody trying to stir up something that isn't there. Okay. I gave you guys credit.
Okay, what'd you say?
I said, shout out to Sean and Seth
because
they clearly have loosened him up.
Okay. Okay, so... Oh, okay. Okay, so the texter was kind of right.
Yes.
He made it sound like
there was a level of attribution.
Make it like,
a blaming
those guys.
Yeah, those guys.
No, I didn't do that.
Yeah, at least that's how I read it.
Yeah.
Some bad headline. That's clickbait. A lot of times people say that. Like the headline will be such and such confesses to something.
Yes.
And you're like, you read the article, you're like, okay, well, there's no confession there.
No. Yeah.
Like it was something that he did something bad.
Yeah.
Oh, so you were saying the version of Nick that we're getting now has a lot to do with the appearances.
I literally
on our show.
Said shout out to the guys because they've clearly loosened him
Thank
up.
Thank you.
Especially when I had an opportunity to go back and look at it, and obviously he throws it out there almost like jokingly.
Yeah.
Like it sounded a little bit more frustrated just with the audio, but seeing it, I'm like, he seems like
he's joking. He circled back to it later and laughed about it.
Yes,
you know? That was. Well, thank you very much. I feel like those appearances
damn texters
are
trying to stir up stuff.
Yeah, you cannot come in between In the Loop and Payne and Pendergast.
Right? You probably could. We are could happen. I think
we are one team. All right,
try harder is what my ultimate
try harder. Yeah.
Crosstalk sponsored by D&M Auto Leasing. So, what's the question of the day, fellas?
Well, it has to do with Nick Caserio.
It does.
Yeah.
Okay.
What are some things that you often lie about with a straight face?
Okay.
Like proudly.
Proudly is an interesting way to go about that.
My wife listens to the show.
I know. I've got a lot of people that listen that I tell.
That's why we always do the question of the day. You got to come clean.
Yeah.
And it may or may not be based on Nick Caserio saying, I would have been fine going into this season with last season's offensive
line. That's a big one.
And I looked at Reggie and Figgy and I went,
you're not acting.
Okay.
Yeah, you're not acting with somebody who would be. I would suppose mine that I'm willing to disclose.
There you go.
I will often fudge the amount that I've had to consume alcohol-wise.
Okay.
You know, like if I'm doing my thing during the day, you know, over at the...
I had like two.
Over at the Zark, I had like two, yeah. It's not to police officers pulling me over. Let me be clear about that. Yeah.
You're always truthful to authority figures.
I don't drink and drive, so that's right. Yeah.
I would say maybe I'm probably, if you were to go through my texts or emails... I would get maybe 25% of the time that I use the acronym NBD is genuine. I 75% of the time when I say NBD, it's like, I just don't want to deal with it. Yeah. Like, yeah, cool, whatever. Yeah. But no, I'll secretly despise you forever.
Well, NBD meaning no big deal, correct?
Yeah, no big deal. Sorry for our 90-year-olds that we were talking about.
That ties in with one of the three that popped in mind that I'm going to share at 1040.
Okay.
But mine is, whenever I text you, like the next day or whatever, I didn't see your text. I saw your text.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. To the extent.
Well, that recontextualized something. All right.
I saw your text.
To the extent, I don't know if I have it set up where people can see. You know, sometimes
I deliberately.
Okay, I got to double check that. Yeah,
that's
like
one
sometimes
thing,
you can see what time it was read or seen.
Yeah, every time you get an update to your operating system or anything, double check that one specifically. Because I think there was one random update a long time ago where that became the default setting.
Yeah.
And people were not happy about it.
Yeah.
That's when you got to fall back on, I saw it, but I just forgot to respond.
Right. How often does your phone die in these lies? Like, sorry, my phone died.
My go-to, I think it's a little more believable. Oh, it was on the charger.
Okay. It was across the room.
Yeah.
Didn't see it.
Which for me is a really bad one, because if I try that and someone knows me well enough, they know that I have like a smartwatch on and I usually
I don't. I hate wearing watches.
I do too. I don't wear any jewelry.
Yeah, I hate wearing
watches.
I don't
wear
watches. My wedding ring. I think it's clammy. It's for whatever reason, my wrist.
What was the lie you told about the wedding ring?
I just don't wear any jewelry. I literally never. Have you ever seen me with any jewelry?
No, I'm not saying that.
That's a lie.
I feel like there's someone that cares if you wear that wedding ring.
She doesn't care.
Are you sure? Or is she lying to you?
Whoa.
We've opened something up.
Mind blown.
That is one. You know, the lie that I advocate women telling all the time is like if somebody's hitting on you or some creeping on you, just say you're married and just be done with it. But like my wife doesn't wear her wedding ring because she just doesn't. It's arthritis or whatever. And I'm too.
Or whatever.
I guess sometime in the last 10 years I could have gotten it resized, but still. But as a woman, I feel like that women. There are a lot of lies that women tell that I completely advocate. Lying about having a boyfriend or a husband when somebody's hitting on you, it's just a get out of jail quick and easy card that like and it saves the guy's feelings a little bit. Yeah. You know, it just doesn't. If it's somebody you're never gonna see again, just get the hell out of there.
Assuming he's not shameless, because there are
some
shameless folks.
I just got two texts, basically the same premise. You bastard, you saw those texts.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Not yours. Except for yours.
That's right.
When it's someone, this is a text, Jim Adler, the Texas Hammer text line. When it's somebody I don't want to talk to and I don't answer, then I delete the missed call from my call log.
I love the extra step.
Yeah.
Like,
never got the call.
No evidence.
Yeah, that's
establishing
good.
Alibis and
that's
such.
That's good, man. What an age we live in, the electronic age. All right, Seth, antibodies to you, my friend.
Oh, antibodies and a long and fruitful career until you die at the microphone at the age of 90.
Thank you.
To you.
Now I'm going to go hit find on all my Seth texts and see how much NBD is in there.
75% of them.
75% of them, Seth's like,
Seth's been just hit the...
The wanking hand motion.
The shake away. The shake weight motion.
Yeah. Shake weight. All right. You're listening to KILT AM, KILT FM HD2, Houston and Odyssey Sports Station.